session number 26369, Reel 2.
I think we were useful, I'm sure. I don't think I've got any note of it here, but M.R.D. Foote, you've heard of him, I'm sure, wrote a book called SOE in the Low Countries, and I'll hand this to you actually as an extract. But there was one group which I did have contact with in Antwerp, the Verstraeten group, and our detachment was helping them infiltrate agents across the River Maas into occupied territory. And in all, I think five were infiltrated, who proved very useful and provided valuable intelligence. So that's about the only occasion I can quote, really. But, and I only became involved with them because one day in Antwerp, I and another wireless operator were called to go down to their HQ. The previous night, they tried to infiltrate an agent, and on the way across the river, they bumped into another boat in the pitch darkness, and they'd shipped a lot of water, and they'd had to come back, and we had been called in to see if we could help them dry out their B2 set and reassemble it. In fact, they knew perfectly well how to do it, so we weren't required, but that was the Verstraeten group, and they managed to get this chap across again, and a few weeks later, when we'd moved on into Holland, we opened up a wireless link for him and listened out, and eventually I happened to be on set when he came up, and he sent us a message, but it sounded, his hand sounded as if it was shaking, it was all. And we never heard from that chap again, I'm afraid.
So had your job changed somewhat by the time you reached up to Antwerp?
Well, that was unusual, to operate a link direct to an agent, and that was the only time it ever happened. No, the job was still basically the same.
And were you still moving with the Canadians?
Yes,
through into Belgium?
Mm-hmm. Well, Belgium into Holland, yep.
How long did you remain with the Canadians?
Oh, well, for the whole time, for the whole of the campaign in Europe. That was our job, to be with them. As I say, into
Philip Dawkins, Reel 2.
We moved, as I said, from Antwerp into Holland to Breda, and then on to Sertogenbosch and Tilburg. And we were at Tilburg when the Germans launched their Ardennes offensive. And one night there was a real flap. It was thought the Germans had broken through, and we had to turn out in the middle of the night, fully armed with 50 rounds of ammunition. And there were bangs and bumps going on all around, and fairy lights going up. It really was a flap, but nothing came of it. And after that, well, time went on, and
how did you feel during that particular flap?
Jittery, quite nervous. Not much fun being turned out on a freezing cold night. Still, if you shivered, you could put it down to the cold, not your own terror. But after that, of course, things really went one way, and eventually preparations were made for crossing the Rhine, and stuff moved up, and we moved up. And I forget, I suppose it was March 45, we crossed the Rhine at Emmerich, and Emmerich itself was totally ruined. There were no people, white flag or sheets hanging from every window, but nobody about. And we gradually moved on through Arnhem up into northern Holland, and came to rest in Utrecht. And this was very near the end of things.
Can you describe what Arnhem was like at that stage of the war?
At that stage, where we moved through, it looked like any other town, nice town, no damage to the part through which we went. I mean, it had been 6 months earlier that the airborne landing had taken place. And Utrecht, well, it was virtually all over, there wasn't much to be done. And the armistice was signed at Lüneburg on May the 4th, though VE Day wasn't till May the 8th. And we immediately discovered that we'd been sharing Utrecht with German soldiers and German nursing assistants, because they came out on the streets. Strange.
How did you hear about the end of the war in Europe?
I don't know, maybe in the BBC, you know, I can't remember. I imagine our CO told us anyway. So really, that was it. We had no further role to fulfil. I mean, the war had finished. And a few days later, I went on what they called BLA leave, British Liberation Army leave, for 7 days. And while I was home, the unit came back for disbandment. So I was told to report back to Milton Hall, which is an SOE base near Peterborough, incidentally where the Jedburghs had trained. And I went back there and said, look here, I've only just come back from France, what about some leave? So I had 10 days disembarkation leave, and reported back to Fawley Court, where I met up with the other chaps who'd come back. And we went on embarkation leave, came back to Fawley for kitting out for the Far East. Total contrast. I mean, when I was at Fawley in 43, it was a very busy place and a real air of purpose there. 45, of course, everything was over and dead there apart from us. And we went back to Milton Hall for a few days and then on to Liverpool and embarked for India. And that would have been in July 45. And
how was the journey out to India?
Very nice. Like a cruise, you know. Went through the Med, it was just like being on a cruise. Passed by the North African coastline, very close to Cape Bon, where the Germans had surrendered in 43. Beautiful calm sea, blue sky. And yet a year earlier, it would have been quite a different tale. And while we were going through the Suez Canal, news came through of the atom bomb. And a few days later, the war was finished. So was our journey really necessary? There it was. And we went on to Bombay, had a few days in Meerut, which was Force 136 HQ, and then was sent down to Ceylon, to Colombo, went down by train. And we had, I suppose, about 3 months in Ceylon, still doing quite a lot of work. The agents were still in place in Malaya and Siam, and we were transmitting to them.
Were you working for a particular section, country section?
I don't think so out there. I mean, in Europe, we were in the French section, obviously, initially anyway, but I don't recall any particular country section out there. I mean, we kept in contact with other bases at Kunming in China and Rangoon, various, you know.
How did that compare to the work he'd been doing previously in Europe?
Well, I mean, it was quite different in a way, and yet, of course, we were wireless operating, which is always much the same, you know. But we were working in Ceylon in a big wireless station, so there were a lot of us sitting around tables with sets in front of us working. Whereas in Europe, we were in a wireless vehicle on our own, just, you know, doing that. Ceylon was a very pleasant place to be. No shortages of anything, really. Lovely beach at Mount Lavinia. So, you know, quite enjoyed that.
Yes, what was it like socially outside of work?
Well, in Ceylon it was fine because there were a lot of the Fannies there. I mean, the Fannies were wireless operators as well, so we socialised with them off duty. And when we were on night duty, the Fanny base was only a short way from the wireless station, so we used to go out to them to have dinner in their mess, which was very pleasant. They were a very nice crowd, the Fannies.
Can you describe a typical day of work in the salon?
Well, you would go on duty, say, at 8 o'clock in the morning. You would replace the operators who'd been on the night shift, and you would take your seat before one of the wireless sets, which were quite big things. I think they were AR-88s, but I can't be sure. And then you would just deal with whatever messages you were handed, or which whatever messages were coming in. You had certain stations, frequencies on which you operated. And you just carried on, took a break when you could, and it was a 4-hour stint. And after that, the time was your own, really. So you would go into Colombo, perhaps, or down to this beach at Mount Lavinia, have a meal at a Chinese restaurant.
So how did that compare to being in Europe?
Well, quite different. I mean, there was only occasionally that, say, in Ghent and Antwerp, that you had access to restaurants or anything of that nature. But, in Belgium, of course, you were very popular, the liberators. The English were very popular then. In Antwerp, you travelled on the trams free of charge. Well, they genuinely liked you at that time.
Was that the same with the Dutch and the French?
Yes, not the French, not in Normandy, not particularly. They had a pretty rough time there, being bombarded and shelled and whatnot, and I think they were fed up with it. In fact, I think many of them wished we hadn't come, you know. because the farmers lost so much of their livestock. There were dead cattle all over the fields there. And it was a hard life for them.
To roll ahead again, how were the locals in Ceylon?
Well, they accepted you. They made money out of you. I wouldn't say they were over-friendly, but they accepted him. They were used to the British being there. No, it was very pleasant there.
How did you come to move on from Ceylon?
Well, at the end of November, we were called together and told that SOE was on the point of finishing. And we were given the option. We could either volunteer to go further east, or we could go back to India to army signals and take it from there. Some went back, but quite a few of us volunteered to go further east. And we became members of Allied Land Forces Paramilitary Operation Southeast Asia, which really was SOE under another name because it fulfilled the same task. And we sailed from Colombo to Singapore and then down to Batavia. And we set up a unit station in a big bungalow which had been in Japanese hands because of all masses of paper in Japanese and typewriters with Japanese keyboards. And our wireless station was on top of the KPM building, which was the Allied Forces Netherlands East Indies HQ, but had previously been the head office of the Dutch Koninklijke Packet Marina steamship line. And we, as I say, had our wireless station on the top of that. And we used to go down every day carrying a B2 set, march up the stairs of the KPM building right to the top and start our wireless transmissions to, well, the other stations operated by paramilitary ops. There was one in Bangkok, one in Kuala Lumpur. I forget where the others were. But
can you tell me a little about the purpose of these particular units?
I wish I knew. We were thwarted in whatever purpose we had because we just couldn't move outside of Batavia because of the activities by the freedom fighters. The only way you could move out of Batavia was in a heavily armed convoy. So that whatever our purpose was, I think there were one or two purposes. One I heard of was to try to find out rice supplies because there was a rice shortage all over Southeast Asia. And another one, I think, was also to make contact with prisoner of war camps in the interior. But unfortunately, we never managed to do that. And after December, January, in February, we had to close down.
Yes, can you tell me a little about the political tension that was in?
Well, there was a great deal of tension. There was also a big British mission in Batavia, headed, I think, by Lord Killam, but I'm not sure, with no end of high-tech radio stuff. They're in contact with London, and they were trying to mediate between Dr. Sukarno, the Indonesian, and the Dutch authorities to try to come to some arrangement. But as for the tension, well, we had to go armed at all times, and we never could go out singly. We had to go at least in pairs. At night there was frequent shooting and explosions. On the ship that we travelled over to Batavia, there were about 500 paratroops who were being sent over to deal with these freedom fighters, and I think they did a good job, actually. There were no end of Japanese about, some of them armed. Well, we were using Japanese troops as guards, and we were also using them down on the docks to unload cargoes. It was rather a curious situation because some of them agreed to fight for us, but others were fighting with the freedom fighters.
How were the Japanese viewed by the locals?
I honestly don't know. No, I really don't know. I mean, by the Dutch, obviously, with hatred, but I mean, Indonesia was a bad place for post-war because I had a note somewhere of the casualties, but I think there were nearly 1,000 British killed out there, British and Indian troops, which is pretty high, really. For
what was the atmosphere among the troops being involved in an operation like this so soon after the end of the war against the Japanese?
Well, as far as I know, it was okay. I mean, the paratroops were highly disciplined lot, so I don't think they'd show much in the way of dissent, but generally speaking, I don't know. I know I was quite pleased to get away from it, but and when we disbanded, I mean, the unit just split up. Some went back to Malaya. Some stayed in Indonesia. I personally went up to Sumatra, to Medan, which was also in some state of tension. We had an armoured car regiment defending the perimeter at Medan, and there was firing most nights, but I don't think there was ever much in the town, though. Once we had a cricket match, we formed a cricket team, and we went down into the town to play on our AF side. And as we got to the ground, we noticed across the road there was a kampong with a great deal of activity and flames and smoke rising from it, and a bit of odd shooting, and we thought, well, But we started the match and hadn't been playing for long, and some stray shots came flying across the ground, so we all fell on the ground. And I think we gave up then and went back to camp. But generally, if you went into Medan, it was quite quiet, and I know I went in one afternoon, and one of the Indian kilted regiments were beating the retreat on the what they called the mangalam there, which was a sort of ritual that was nice to see, a peacetime sort of ritual.
Can you describe it?
Well, I mean, they were very colourful in their kilts and tartan, and they had a pipe band, and they just paraded up and down playing.